John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We've got a full hour on this Friday the 13th. Lots to talk about, and your conversation is already going on fairy tales that you may have experienced. We're going to talk about a conference of masculinity taking place, and that's something that bears fairly directly on some of the problems that we're dealing with in this hour. What are the ways in which the voices in Ferguson, Missouri begin to regain the trust that has been lost in the violence over the past year and the latest violence over the past week? There are rituals of news conferences and statements of political leaders that are one narrative.
You know, I think that what had been happening in Ferguson was oppressive and objectionable and was worthy of protest. But there was no excuse for criminal acts. And whoever fired those shots shouldn't detract from the issue. They're criminals.
President Obama referring to the shootings of two officers this week that have complicated affairs and complicated the details in Ferguson, which we're going to talk about. These carefully measured statements of political leaders are just part of the process of reconciliation. Criminal investigations, while crucial, are also just a piece of the puzzle. There's a school of thought that in communities of violence and social unrest, there is a mechanism of theater to be brought to bear. The acting out of passions and anger in a safe, honest place where people get to air their grievances, a process of theater called theater of the oppressed, which actually uses theater to face the hard questions between peoples. It's a famous doctrine created by the legendary Brazilian dissident and artist and director, the late Augusto Boal. Here he is speaking back in 2009.
We believe that all relationship between humans should be a dialogue on nature. We should have the moment in which we listen to the other and the moment in which we speak. But we know that between men and women, between blacks and whites, between North Hemisphere countries and South Hemisphere, all those dialogues, they become very soon a monologue in which only men speak, only whites speak, and then we want to reestablish the dialogue. We want to have the right also to say our words. That's what we mean, us, the oppressed.
A theater of the oppressed. Can theater bring a dialogue back into a productive, healthy exchange between people who have strong disagreements in a community like Ferguson? We can see it in Ferguson in the clergy speaking from the pulpit, and community activists speaking from the soapbox, and people literally creating theater pieces to tell the stories of what has happened during the shooting of Michael Brown and the months afterward in Ferguson, Missouri. Joining us now is Cecilia Nadal, executive director of Hitana Productions, an arts and education organization in St. Louis, with a theater piece that opens in May. Cecilia, welcome to The Takeaway.
I'm pleased to be here.
And Willis Johnson is a pastor at Ferguson's Wellspring Church who has certainly been using the narrative of Ferguson every Sunday in his church. Willis, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
How do you think the ideas of theater, of creating safe places for people to speak their minds, to play characters of the oppressed, how does that help people to understand what's going on in their community? Willis?
As you've mentioned before, it allows for voice to be raised and heard. It allows for the personal exploration of self. Ultimately, we are trying to not only discern, and particularly in instances of trauma, rediscover our authentic self. And so this kind of exercise of exploration and expression to the other, in being able to not only identify and discover and discern, but then to display or to interpret to others fully the feeling, the emotion, the embodiment of the authentic self or the projected self in either case is an awesome thing. It's a welcome. It's a necessary and almost therapeutic gift.
Can you describe an example of where you've gotten from monologue to dialogue in some of your work there in the Wellspring Church?
Well, obviously, you know, I have a unique privilege to stand before and yet an unusual challenge to kind of represent the interest and agency and authority that is beyond myself, and to speak with that authority and to speak in translation of ancient texts and in relationship to modern reality. And so the sermonic expression and opportunity is very much perceived to be a monologue, but really it's a dialogue with scripture and people, and then ultimately that leads from that moment into the carryover, raising question and allowing people to engage in that in their own way, in their own space. At the same time, we reconvene and reconfigure for that kind of debriefing later in the week through different teachings, small groups, gatherings. But that monologue, that moment of monologue, directs and leads, hopefully, people into further conversation and reflection.
Talking with Willis Johnson, pastor at Ferguson's Wellspring Church in Ferguson, Missouri. This is The Takeaway. So, Cecilia Nadal, your show Black and Blue opens in May. Tell me what it's about and how theater empowers people to speak their mind.
Well, let me start with our process, because that is as important as the show itself. I was a participant for almost 15 days in the protest as soon as they started. And we tried to figure out, while out there and being a part of the protest, what is the way that our organization, which has a mission of healing, what is the way that we can contribute to this issue? And it was very clear to me that the energy of the protest and the fight for justice was a kind of energy where reflection was very important. So the first step we took in the process was to invite members of the protest community to be a part of a storytelling drama class at Greater St. Mark's Church. We asked them to come with the premise of, let's just talk about what you're thinking about, let's talk about what's important to you, and what are the issues? Getting out of the energy of the protests to reflection. And so for 8 weeks, we worked with protesters telling their stories, talking about where they were before the protest, what happened during the protest, and where did they see their lives going after the protest. That process allowed for an internal dialogue for the people who were there, where they could really think about not just what happened and what they did, but where it was all going. And that proved to be very important. The next step in the process was to think about the other side, so to speak. What are the issues that police face when they are dealing with confrontation? What are the institutional issues that put police in the position of sometimes making really bad decisions? So we did things like role play, and the protesters had to step into that role to figure out what happened to police officers when they are in the moment of defending themselves, if it is a defense. As we did the class, we asked for Lee Patton-Childs to come on to write the play. What she uses is something called verbatim theater. And that's a process where you talk to people, you hear their words, and you incorporate those words into the play.
Well, you describe exactly the mission of Theater of the Oppressed, of having the complexity of the real feelings that people have in a situation like this, have that complexity be reassuring. It allows people to feel as though their voices are heard. Any sort of comments, Willis Johnson, about this process of dialogue using theater, as skilled as you are from the pulpit?
You know, that is really not only the context for the preaching, but it really harkens to the tradition of the prophet from the 8th century into even the modern era, where we like to reflect on King and others. This idea that we want to lift every voice, and give the fullest measure of expression, human expression, with this kind of almost divine, mystic, deep, soulful kind of understanding is very much in line of the prophets. And so whether it's King's elaboration on such, where he talks about that riot is the expression of the voice for the voiceless, we now have the unique design of using whatever discipline and a means that we think is best to begin to share ourself, and our authentic self and raise up not only consciousness, but hopefully our humanity. And have it presented in a space, whether that's from the church and in community there, or in through community and expressive theater, people can find a way to connect and have translation.
Well, I'm hearing a hopeful message from both of you. Am I getting that wrong, Cecilia and Willis?
No, you're not getting that wrong. I am very hopeful. I'd like to respond to something that Pastor said, which is right on, and that is this issue of not just looking at the other point of view, but also understanding that we're connected through our humanity. I think that's a very important point, and it's the point from which we can get to things that are complex. Let me give you an example. We had two police officers who were shot recently in Ferguson. Thank God they were not killed. And we are very touched by that. One officer from Webster, another one from St. Louis County. And they were just trying to help out. And two people, whoever it was, did this madness to hurt those two individuals. Now, as I have listened to the news media across the country, you hear constantly the violence in Ferguson was such that now we really wonder whether the protests are going in the right direction, blah, 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 blah. Very simplistic thinking, not critical thinking. The fact is that with the protest in Ferguson, there has been less violence than proportionately than regular crime on the streets. The news media does not get to that complexity, and we can do that in theater. We can talk about issues that seem to be simple, and we can get to the complexity in such a way that people are more informed and much better able to look at why they take the position that they take. We are so polarized in St. Louis that if we don't have that moment in which we can steep into complexity and ferret out what's important and what is not, we cannot get to healing.
Cecilia Nadal is executive director of Hitana Productions, an arts and education organization in St. Louis, and Willis Johnson is pastor at Ferguson's Wellspring Church. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From the challenging reality there in Ferguson to the whimsy of fairy tales, later this hour, a new treasure trove of lost German folktales. We're asking about your favorite personal stories and what they taught. From New York City, Hansel and Gretel, because it taught me that with ingenuity and guts, nobody could ever get the best of me. Tony from Detroit, Michigan, Jack and the Beanstalk taught me that there is treasure beyond my reach, so think creatively if I want to access it.
Hi, this is Charmin from Dallas. I always loved The Princess and the Pea because it showed me that no matter what else was going on, I could always be true, I could always hold the high standards, and I didn't have to bow down to anyone. If there was a pea in my bed under that mattress, even if it was under 20 mattresses, I could let people know.
Hi, this is Annika Dame. I'm calling from Middletown, Connecticut. One of my favorite fairy tales is The White Dove, and it taught me that where you lose the path in the woods is not where your story ends.
877-8-MY-TAKE to share your favorite tale. More on the magic and power of fairy tales. That's later. Some thoughts about masculinity now. Tough, masculine public radio hosts. You know what I'm talking about. These are the giants of our time. You can't get more masculine than prairie home companion. This American life. Gritty names like Glass, Ira, Rizdahl, Kai, Inskeep, Steve, Hockenberry. People you wouldn't want to meet in a dark alley. People who would bore you to death. Public radio voices. That's a macho that Hollywood can only dream about.
My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius, and I will have my vengeance.
Add me some money and add me some medals.
Who paid for that college education? Your mother?
But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward.
Whatever happened to Gary Cooper? the strong, silent type.
Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns.
You make sounds like you're a mean little ass kicker. Only I ain't convinced. You keep talking, I'm going to take your head off.
Charles Bronson from Mr. Majestic. Okay, I'll admit that masculinity is a bit confused and complex in our time. Is it Lena Dunham or Adam who's the mas macho in this little scene from Girls?
I have to go back to the party.
Okay, Hannah, stop! You're the best thing in my life. I don't know how to behave without you. I'd die if you go away.
I don't want to be with you.
You do. We laid right there in that bed a month ago, and you told me if you ever broke up with me that I shouldn't let you.
Perhaps there's no better evidence that masculinity has lost its certain clarity of the traditional days than the International Conference on Masculinities, an annual academic conference where both men and women alike gather to discuss what it means to be a man. Adam Gabbett of The Guardian, U.S., attended this year's conference. He joins us in the studio to share what he learned, how it spoke to him as a man in today's world. Adam, welcome.
Hi.
Got some beef jerky there if you want.
Fantastic. Thank you. My favorite.
Sure. So how was it? I mean,
it was a real eye-opener. I found out that, in my eyes, masculinity is in crisis. Men don't exist. Well, men do exist in the same way is the point that I found. Even men who, as one of the sessions in the conference said, even men who like My Little Pony, they're known as bronies, you would think that they might be more sensitive, more sort of into women's things. But it turns out these men are still bound by traditional masculine roles, like some of the characters you've heard there.
So there's a Charles Bronson who loves My Little Pony kind of thing. I mean, John Wayne had a doll collection, I believe.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, the point that people were making in the conference is that even people who try and escape those traditional masculine things, whether it's Charles Bronson, whether it's Arnold Schwarzenegger, that kind of strong, stoic man who just, you know, lifts weights, gets the job done, comes home, doesn't talk about it. Even men who are trying to escape that by liking My Little Pony or another session in the conference by being nerds and self-describing as that, they are still subject to the same kind of hegemonic masculinity, it's called, the same sort of stereotypical manhood. They are still bound by that.
So this conference described nerds as sort of masculine dissidents attempting to escape the prison of macho?
Yes, exactly. Mm. They are...
How are they doing? Are they escaping? Are they?
They're not escaping at all.
They're oppressed,
sadly. Yeah, they're still. So these nerds in particular were taking part in Dagger Here, which is they dress up as characters from similar to Lord of the Rings. They've got foam swords and stuff like that, and they run around fields. But it was found that they are still basically, in the way they interact with each other, in the way they interact with women in particular, they're still just the same as, you know, the guy down the pub ordering 7 pints of Coors.
All right, so I'm just getting an impression of this conference that on the one side there are men all over the place just weeping quietly to themselves, and then in the other rooms there are women going, it wasn't like that.
No, you know, I spoke to some women there who were genuinely concerned for men.
Oh, that's so sweet of them. Yeah, that's so nice.
You know, having heard these tales, so people were doing research into men and presenting this research. And I spoke to a couple of women afterwards and they said, is this really what's happening with men? This sounds awful. They found out that even sort of nerds, in inverted commas, even people who like My Little Pony, they still won't talk to other men about their feelings. They still won't talk to close friends about their feelings. And they said, well, I just would call my girlfriends up and talk about how I'm feeling. Does that not happen with men? Hmm.
And so there could be a website for men to talk about My Little Pony, but there could never be a bar where men would go and talk about My Little Pony.
Exactly. And I think the point is that even in the bar, if you're not talking about My Little Pony, men aren't really talking about their feelings in a kind of sincere way. Maybe they are after enough pints, but they aren't really kind of expressing themselves very well.
I'm curious a little bit about the My Little Pony thing. Is that a big movement that I've just really kind of missed? I mean, my girls are into My Little Pony, but my...
it's massive, especially there. So obviously it's aimed at girls, children, but there's bronies, as they're known, fans of My Little Pony. And they are sort of men between about 20 and 35, tend to not really be sort of your typical masculine males, but then are really into My Little Pony. And within that, there's a subset who really, really, really like My Little Pony and almost fetishize, well, they do fetishize My Little Pony.
You're scaring me now. Adam Gabbett writes for The Guardian US. This is The Takeaway. So do women feel as though something needs to be fixed? Do men come to this conference as a way of sharing sort of cutting edge new notions of masculinity?
So a lot of the men who come to the conference are activists or researchers, therapists, that sort of thing.
I would think, yeah.
Yeah, and women do feel that something needs to be fixed, but so do the men there. One of the ways they're doing this is just by they're exploring different ways of getting men to talk about themselves. And one of the most interesting things I heard was someone who's hosting friendship labs where he gets some of his kind of people together who can't express themselves, some of the men, and has them talk among each other. And he's sat there as a therapist, guiding them on how to express their feelings, how to interact with friends, in some cases through the use of what he calls a feelings wheel.
Mm. I'll have some more beef jerky there.
Thank you
for coming. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, throw some ball.
Yeah. Adam Gabbett writes for The Guardian US, talking about the Masculinity Conference here in New York.
The Takeaway is supported by ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at shopkeep.com.
The ultimate tough guy of the Roman Empire, friend's Roman's countryman Julius Caesar, met his demise on March 15th, 44 BC, the Ides of March, an even more intimidating date than little old Friday the 13th. But that distorter of history, Shakespeare, concocted the famous warning, "Beware the Ides of March." It never happened. And the real details of the assassination are quite a yarn in and of themselves. Barry Strauss is a professor of history at Cornell University and author of The Death of Caesar, the story of history's most famous assassination.
Oh, they certainly mark their time on the event of this assassination. It's one of the most famous dates in Roman history. It would have been hard to ignore it when Augustus becomes emperor, and even before, he has the Senate House, where the Senate met that day, he has it walled up so that it will never be used again. And he declares the day a day of to commemorate parricide, killing one's father, because Caesar was the father of his country.
And indeed, the legacy retains that quality in the Ides of March of the 21st century. You think about
indeed.
Julius Caesar,
yes.
You think about the Ides of March. The line, the Feast of the Lupercal from Julius Caesar in Shakespeare, what does that refer to? It's a pagan festival, and it actually has political significance here.
Yeah, this is a festival that took place on February 15th, so a month before the Ides of March. And it was a festival of purification and of fertility. But on the Feast of the Lupercal in 44 BC, Caesar was seated on the rostra, the speaker's platform in the forum. And when the chief priest of the festival, Mark Antony, ran up to Caesar, he offered him the kingship. And Caesar ostentatiously turned it down. There were many in Rome who concluded that this was all a trial balloon, that Caesar was behind the whole thing. And he was testing what the public's reaction would be were he to become king.
In Shakespeare, the ritual of the assassination is meticulously seen as everybody has to stab him so that everybody has blood on their hands. Is that historically accurate?
I don't think it is. Caesar only got 23 wounds, and we know that there were more than 60 conspirators. Perhaps it was the case that it was the conspirators in the main group and in the core of the conspiracy. Perhaps they all had to stab Caesar. But I think there were others in the Senate that day whose job was largely to prevent help from coming to Caesar.
Shakespeare would have us believe that then after 23 wounds, Caesar goes, "And you too, Brutus?"
Yeah. You know, the et tu, Brute, is an Elizabethan invention. There's nothing about that in the ancient sources. What the ancient sources do report is a rumor that what Caesar said in the midst of being stabbed was something in Greek. He said, kai sou technon, which means you too, child. The ancient sources go on to say, well, we don't believe he could have said anything because he was too busy fighting for his life. But if he did say, you too, child, and the sources say it was directed at Brutus, what did he mean by this? One possibility is he was referring to the rumor that Brutus was his illegitimate son, and he might have been insulting Brutus by saying, you just killed your father, and so you've committed a heinous crime. Or he might have been quoting a line from a Greek play that went on to say, you too, child, will one day taste power such as mine. Or he might have been quoting a common thing on a curse tablet, and the Romans used curse tablets in which they would write, same to you. So any one of those is a possible interpretation of what he meant.
So on the Ides of March, do you think all world leaders think to themselves, wonder if I'm going to get through this day?
Well, you know, probably most world leaders are too busy to think about that sort of thing, and maybe as a self-defense they try not to. But you got to imagine there's some of them who do wonder because it's a terrifying possibility.
Barry Strauss, thanks so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Barry Strauss is a history professor at Cornell University, author of The Death of Caesar, the story of history's most famous assassination. In the original Cinderella, you may remember, the ugly stepsisters actually sliced parts of their feet off to get them to fit into Cinderella's glass slippers. Yikes. Shades of foot and footwear abuse in our time, perhaps? Disney's source material, truth be told, seriously downplays all of the girl-eating wolves and girl-enslaving fathers and kings from the fairy tales, the witches brewing poison and bringing death to the adorable young faces you can find in them. Hey, Disney, Pixar, how about a turnip that turns into a princess, or maybe a toad, a whole bunch of new German fairy tale storylines have been found in a box in the city of Regensburg, Germany. More than 500 fairy tales that had been forgotten for over a century and a half. The tales had been compiled by Franz Xaver von Schönwandt, a 19th century Regensburg civil servant with a passion for folklore, and the stories can now be read in English for the first time in a book called The Turnip Princess and Other Newly Discovered Fairy Tales. The characters in these stories are familiar, but the scenarios, like the original Grimm brothers, are all strangely dark. A prince with golden hair toils secretly as a gardener after his father tries to kill him. A toad turns into a beautiful bride. Great. A dragon is betrayed by his wife. Maria Tatare, professor of Germanic languages and literatures at Harvard, is the book's translator. She's also chair of Harvard's folklore and mythology program.
Well, you have to remember, they did emerge from oral storytelling cultures at a time when life was nasty, brutish, and short. But I think much more importantly, they are larger than life, and I would say twice as unnatural. They give us excess, exaggeration, melodrama. Remember, these were stories designed to keep people awake so that they could finish their chores. So they're full of the same things that we have in our entertainments today. They give us the great what-ifs. What if the worst thing imaginable happened? What would you do? How would you survive it?
Do you think the turnip princess story, the narrative there, got people talking?
Oh, for sure, because one of the things I love about the Schönwandt collection is that it's full of gaps and contradictions. So the story is told, and, you know, you're immediately asking yourself, wait a minute, what was that old woman doing there? Is she identical with the turnip princess? Why the rusty nail? So they are full of mysteries. They raise questions all the time. And, you know, think about that oral storytelling situation where the story is told, there's an audience present, so the teller is constantly being interrupted, there's commentary, and then I'm sure that there's a kind of reflex that takes place where somebody says, oh, I know another story sort of like that, or I can tell it better.
What do we know about Schönwandt?
Well, we know that he was interested in what the brothers Grimm were doing, and he was deeply committed to his Bavarian homeland and wanted to sort of be the Bavarian answer to the brothers Grimm, collect folklore. He was less connected to this idea of a creating a literary heritage. That is, he really wanted to capture the voice of the people. And I love the fact that he found that his informants were reluctant to tell the story. So what did he do? He started bribing them. Now, of course, you might ask, doesn't that mean that the informants sort of gave him a distorted version of these stories? They gave him fairy tales that aimed to please an academic. There may be a certain amount of truth to that. But what Schoenvatt found was once they became comfortable with him, they really got into the storytelling mode.
As a folklorist, can you tell the difference between a tale which might have been elaborated upon to get maybe more of a payment and one that might have been absolutely authentic, that could have survived for, you know, many, many hundreds of years, passed down generation to generation?
Oh, that's really tough. It is a challenge to try to separate those things out. I've often found that the inclusion of a moral is a tip-off to the fact that there is a certain amount of editing going on, and that there's an effort, you know, to clean up the story, to move it from the fireside where adults were telling these racy body stories into the nursery where you were trying to discipline the child to be obedient, because if they were not, something terrible could happen to them. I think of the Grimm's Frog Prince and the moment when the father says to his daughter, if you made a promise, you must keep it. Now, the promise is that she lets the frog sleep with her in her bed. And that frog, of course, as we know, turns into a prince. But, you know, that odd lesson, which doesn't really square with what's going on in the story. So when I see this disconnect between the story and the lesson that is embedded in it, I know that there's something strange going on in terms of editing.
With Schoenvatt's work, there's also the narrative of taking the stories and using them for political means. And this was done in the 1930s. There are certainly lots of examples of stories being used for nationalist aims of one kind or another. How did that work here in the Schoenvatt stories?
Schoenvatt's collection, of course, wasn't in the school curriculum the way that the Brothers Grimm were. And, of course, what raised a red flag in the post-war era, post-World War II, were stories like not only Hansel and Gretel, where the witch is famously shoved into an oven, but there are a couple of virulently anti-Semitic tales in the Grimm's collection. The Jew in the Thorn Bush is one of them. And the stories in the post-war period were banned from schools. What is interesting to me is you don't find a trace of anti-Semitism in Schoenvatt.
You know, when I read the Turnip Princess, I can't help but kind of distort it through my own lens because it does feel like something that's improvised, almost like a jazz solo. Somebody, like, tell me a story now. And with my own kids, you know, oh, well, there was this turnip, like the one right here, and it turns into a giant bowl over here. And do you see them holding together in some way, or following a rhythm that we maybe don't understand these days?
I love the blues metaphor or analogy, because it is a little bit, there's a quality of improvisation and then splicing things together and taking bits and pieces from what surrounds you, from everyday reality, but then adding magic and the extraordinary. I love the title Turnip Princess because it melds the ordinary with the extraordinary, a princess. And that is part of the art of storytelling.
I give it about 6 months and there'll be an indie band called Turnip Princess.
Let's hope so.
Maria, thanks so much.
Great to talk with you.
Maria Tatar teaches folklore and literature at Harvard. She's the translator of The Turnip Princess and other newly discovered fairy tales by Franz Xaver von Schoenvatt. Head over to our website to listen to readings from three of these stories, The Wolves, The Toad Bride, and The Howling of the Wind. And here's something to take with you today.
And look, glass slippers. Why, it's like a dream, a wonderful dream come true.
So let's make this Disney dream come true.
I see a really sparkly shoe. It's silver, and it's really, really shiny and has jewels encrusted, and it's really pretty.
Well, Courtney from New Jersey, gazing wide-eyed through the window at Saks Fifth Avenue, those custom-designed Jimmy Choo's glass slippers adorned with Swarovski crystals can be yours, if only for $5,000, even if they have your size.
But you see, I have the other slipper.
Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Have a great weekend. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.